Jessica and I have forgotten to turn that thing on every week.
Yep.
So every recording of this is missing the first few minutes every single time.
Who's going to forget tonight? Both of us.
Yeah. I said to her a few minutes ago, so which one of us is going to forget to do it this time? And she said, well, probably both of us. And we did. Okay.
Yep.
So fine-tuning, which you'll remember from last week, it doesn't happen just once. It happens again and again and again. There's a sequence of sequences. These are magnificent surprises to physicists, but again, not to us. If you think that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, then you might suspect there's going to be something like this. If you think that the God you worship on Sunday morning and all through the week, if you think that this God is infinitely intelligent, and you should think that, then you should expect, you should have a very high bar of expectations of what the creation is going to look like. And what our physicists have uncovered is it exceeds expectations. So when we start to look into these things, what we find is a kind of beauty, not a beauty that one sees with the eyes, but you see it with the mind. And you see it with your soul when you really study these things. That's what we're doing now. And we're going to do more of that tonight. Now, it's a little harder to see it at first with evolution. And maybe it's a little scarier. But we'll get over that. Because I'm going to show how every challenge of evolution, every single one, turns out to be an advantage for us. Okay, so there's massive scientific evidence that the universe was a set-up job. And so let me quote again Isaiah. For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, who formed the earth and made it. He did not create it a chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. He formed it for us. He formed it for people who could know and be known, who could love and be loved. The cosmos takes about 10 billion years 10 billion before there's any life that we know about. Now, there may have been life elsewhere. You know, our Lord once said, I have many sheep who are not of this flock. And I always think that he wasn't just talking about the Greeks. You know, he was thinking about life on other planets. And that's entirely possible. We really don't know that. But we know there are billions of other planets that could potentially support life. And that would make sense. And if they are around, I figure someday we could welcome anybody we run into as brothers. So there are many mansions in our Father's universe. So 10 billion years before the biology starts. Now, I want you to keep that in mind as we get into the biology. There's this 10 billion year sequences before the biology even starts. And no one knows exactly how the biology starts. There are theories. Okay. Producing a universe through logos, through reason, the reason of God, the reason that there is reason. Producing a universe of logos and a universe that is lawful is superior to producing a universe through miracle or magic. That's the universe we have. And if you think about it for just a minute, it really is to the greater glory of God that it's done this way and not through, like, just poof or something like this. Even the electronics is with us tonight, Father. Okay. So, in a sense, the kind of law that you see everywhere, reliable, dependable, repeatable patterns of law that can be known and understood by the human mind, that already is a miracle. If you shouldn't take that for granted, like we got lucky and the universe just turned out this way. That's actually that's not a scientific idea. That's a stupid idea. You know, it's just by chance. Now, people actually say that. Sometimes some Nobel-winning scientists have said dumb stuff like that. But it really is It's not anything that would pass a philosophy course at St. Thomas. So now let's go to this next point here. Fact, hypothesis, and theory. We need to get straight about that. Many people think science is about facts, and it is. That's part of the story. But if it's just a bunch of facts, you just wouldn't have any way of organizing facts, understanding which facts were important. The way scientists do this is two ways. It starts with a hypothesis, where you think something's going to be right, and so you spend time investigating it. That's what scientists do. Now, scientists don't come up with the most unlikely hypothesis. They come up with one that they have a strong hunch is going to be true, because they're going to have to spend their time and their money and their resources looking for to prove that it's true. When a hypothesis is proven to be true, it then goes to a higher status, and that's called theory. Now, this is important. It's because I want to read you something that St. John Paul II actually said about this. I'll give you the context first. On June 28, 1996, John Paul welcomed a group to the Vatican Academy of Sciences in Rome, a group of some of the best philosophers, biologists, and theorists about evolution to Rome. So as they opened their exploration, he came and gave the opening talk, and he said to them, quoting, he said it in Latin, and I'll translate it. He said, "You should truly love the mind." He was quoting St. Augustine. "Love the mind. Love the reason that God gave you." And then he said to them another thing. He said, "Let your work," and I quote, "benefit the human family. Let your scientific exploration be a benefit to all of humankind." And then the third thing he said, "Let your work contribute to the understanding of what it means to be a human person." We're going to look into these a little bit later tonight. And then, after they met for weeks and weeks, on October 22nd, 1996, he reaffirmed and shocked many people. He reaffirmed what Pius XII had said in Humani Generis on how human beings are come to be, an encyclical from 1950. And he said, "There is no opposition between evolution and the doctrines of the Catholic faith." Let me repeat that. "There is no opposition between evolution and the doctrines of the Catholic faith." Now, a lot of evangelical Protestants were just outraged and shocked and scandalized by this. But he held his ground beautifully on this, and for good reason. Now, he said, "There are several conditions, however, that the Catholic Church insists upon. One, evolution is not the whole picture of the human race. It doesn't tell you everything you need to know." And by the way, it doesn't. He was very well informed. He knew the biology. Evolution does not tell you everything you need to know about what it means to be a human being. Number two, these are stipulations that the Catholic Church holds alongside evolution, that each human soul is directly created by God. And number three, that evolution is a theory about how the human body comes to be, but it doesn't tell you how the human soul comes to be. Now, the human soul, in the tradition, consists of the mind or intellect — those words can be used interchangeably — and the will, the free will. Whenever you say will, you always imply free will. So intellect and will is the way we refer to it. But it always means mind and free will. But there's something else that the soul does, in my judgment. I believe that the soul is the part of us that can sense the presence of God. It's the part of us that can feel and respond to the divine presence. There's part of the soul that's even higher than the mind. It's at the very, very upper reach of the mind where the divine downreach can touch us. It doesn't happen in our elbow. I mean, unless you're doing something strange. Right? But there's something about us, we really can. You've experienced this. Many, many, many of you have experienced this. The presence of God in the Eucharist, in your prayer life. You've experienced it. And that's what the soul can do. That doesn't come from evolutionary biology. So John Paul was right about all three of these claims, I think. Now, there was a very good Catholic biologist and thinker, St. George Mivart, end of the 19th century, shortly after Darwin's theory appeared, and he said, he made a distinction between absolute creation. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God, and everything that came into being through the Logos. Remember that one? Just remind. Okay. Absolute creation. Creatio ex nihilo. But then he said there's another kind of creation, which he called derivative creation, a secondary kind of creation. Now think about that for just a moment. What if creation was so creative that inside it were seeds of creativity? Now how beautiful is that? That's what I'm going to struggle to show you tonight, is that as threatening as this evolution starts off being, it's actually presenting the creativity of creation. And this is just additional reason to love and admire the Creator. Okay, so look at your sheet, if you would, to H there. I want to talk to you just a bit about St. Thomas Aquinas' method. Whenever he wrote in his great works, there would be three parts. So he would start with objections to the position that he was going to take. It's a very, very honest and open-minded way to begin. So he starts, these are all the problems, and he lists them. These are the accusations that, you know, even things like atheists believe. This is what the atheist says. And so he lays out all the positions, usually somewhere between 3 and 5 normally, at the beginning of a question that he's exploring. And then, after he's given, he lists those and who held them and why, briefly, he pivots in what in the Latin is called sed contra, which means, but on the other hand. So there's a pivot. Now, tonight, what we're going to do, we have to do it this way to get to the good stuff that's coming in the next 3 weeks. The next 3 weeks are the third part that St. Thomas would do, which is, he'd give his own answer. In order to give our answer, we have to do the work we're going to do tonight, which is get good at the objections. We'll do a little bit of a pivot. At the end of tonight, if you look on the back, I've typed out the parable of the talents. And this is going to be like a theme for us for the rest of our time together. So we'll read that, talk about that in the last, tonight before we leave, the last 15 or 20 minutes or so. Okay, so let's get into the tonight's work with this as background. I've written it up as 4 challenges, but we might even do 5 tonight, which would be including the origin of the first human, if we have time. Okay, well, here's a picture of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was a British aristocrat, a country. He lived in the country. He preferred the country. He was Cambridge educated. He was a very decent and good man in many, many ways. He spent his life conflicted, and he wasn't sure about God. He just wasn't sure. What you see on the right there is the strands of DNA, the helix of DNA. Now, this was a cartoon that came out about shortly after the publication. You can see that he's being compared to an orangutan, with the old spelling there. Not very complimentary to Charles. Charles married Emma Wedgwood, who actually was his first cousin. And yes, that did cause some problems. Now, they didn't know at the time. They should have known, but they didn't. They had 9 kids, and several of them were very sick, and one of them died rather young. And Darwin kind of figured it out after the 9-year-old girl died, whom he loved very, very dearly. But he married the Wedgwood that is the family of Wedgwood pottery. If any of you have that, we don't. But I've been told it's the top of the top stuff. Seeing it, no. And there's Emma. Emma was she might best be described as a Unitarian. She didn't really hold to the Trinity, but she was a very devout woman. And she loved the Gospel of John, and before she would agree to marry Charles in their correspondence, she didn't exactly say, I'm not going to do it unless, but she just made it pretty clear she wanted him to read the Gospel of John, which she thought was a very spiritual gospel. And he did, and they had a nice correspondence about the Gospel of John. So all his life, I think his wife helped keep Darwin on the reservation. He respected her too much to just rule out her faith and faith in God. So he sometimes, in writing to Christians, there was one in particular in America, Asa Gray, when he wrote to Asa Gray, he would actually say that he thought there had to be a creator who set this thing up and then left the details to chance. But on his deathbed, I think he was still struggling with it. He did get buried in Westminster Cathedral, in the Church of England, which they wouldn't have done if they thought he really was an atheist. Okay, moving on to one of the ways this problem of evolution gets set up. There was a famous English writer, William Paley, who published an important book in 1802 called Natural Theology. Now, Paley said, if you're walking along in the English countryside and you find a rock, the rock could have been there forever. It's part of nature. But if you keep going and you find a very, very beautiful watch, there are all these intricate parts inside the watch. It's impossible that the watch just was part of nature. Somebody had to put the watch there. By the way, in the early 1800s, can you guess what the new technology was? It was about watches and watchmakers, so machines. So they would use metaphors that were guided by the cutting-edge technology of their time, which was watchmaking. So the watch took so many balancings and springs and whatnot to be balanced just right that he said it couldn't be done by accident. Then Paley made his most interesting move, because Paley was a biologist as well as an Anglican priest. And he said, as complicated as that watch is, the human eye, where did the human eye go? Oh, there it is. Clicked away from it. The human eye is hundreds, thousands of times more complicated than the watch. Therefore, he said, there must have been a creator who designed the human eye. Now, the human eye has been one of the central battlegrounds between evolutionary theorists and anti-evolutionary theorists, most of whom are evangelical Protestants. But the eye has been one of the central, because people just say it couldn't have been designed, that somebody had to set that up. However, Darwin's theory is going to give you an alternate explanation of how the human eye can be created in a derivative way, not an original creation, but in a derivative way over many, 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 many millions of generations. Okay, so in 1859, Darwin publishes his Origin of Species. This, everybody knew he was working on this, and he finally came out with it because someone else, William Wallace, was about to publish it at the same time, so he finally, he was afraid he'd get scooped, so they worked out a gentlemanly agreement, and they published about the same time. Darwin, by the way, lived in the same college rooms as Paley had lived at Cambridge. Just, that's not important to your relationship with God, it's just a little tangent. But Cambridge had a long tradition of studying biology. So, and they still do. Many of the greatest biologists in the world have come out of Cambridge in England. Way fast forward to 1953, you see Watson and Crick discover that DNA is the genetic material and the secret of heredity. So Darwin suspected there had to be something like this, but he didn't know what it was. When you put the two together, Darwin and DNA, you get what's called the neo-Darwinian synthesis. That's the combination of the two. All right, pressing on. Evolution has three essential ingredients: random mutations, natural selection, and extreme lengths of time, which are called geologic time or geological time. Way, way longer than the human lifespan. So we tend to think in terms of our own lifespan. You can't do that. You have to get beyond it to get into how this thing works, because all three of these are essential to the theory. All right, now at its worst, and that's what we're going to do in the next few minutes, look at evolution at its worst. There are theories of evolution that are not so unfriendly. We're going to take on the biggest, baddest one in the room, and we can still, we're still going to, spoiler alert, we're still going to defeat it. Okay, so the argument that God is the grand designer, that God provides the order that we see in nature, in oak trees and in ducks and in the human eye, this was upset by evolution. Deeply, deeply upset. Well, it turns out in this neo-Darwinian synthesis that each one of us has about 3.1 billion letters of DNA. Now, that works really well, but each one of us also has about 60 mutations where something actually, there's some kind of mistake. Normally, all 60 of those are harmless. Occasionally, someone will unfortunately get a mutation that will cause something like cystic fibrosis or some kind of a disease that is very troublesome. But most of us, most of the time, do not. Now, mutations do two things. They do a lot of harm. They're more likely to do harm than good. But when they do good, they bring amazing novelty and strength. So look at this. Look at this insect. Now, when I look at that insect, the coloration, the length, the muscular system, the eyes, blended in and hiding from birds that want to eat it. I see that and I say, I get inspired. That is extremely beautiful. That a system of life is creative enough through its competition to produce something that wonderful. See, if you were a grasshopper or a praying mantis, and you have wings and you can jump, you know, you fly a little bit, not too far, but a little bit, you can jump, that's good. But, you know, birds can go faster than that. You have a much better chance of staying alive, and here's the next part of the theory, and having offspring, getting your genes into the next generation. That's what biologists mean by being fit. They don't mean like you're all Arnold Schwarzenegger used to be, or somebody like that. You know, they, or you're beautiful, or something. They mean that you succeed in getting, you mate, and you get your genes into the next generation. That's how they define fitness. Well, that kind of camouflage is going to help you, because you're way, way more likely to survive if you have that kind of camouflage than if you don't. And that's the way the theory works. And there's a frog who suffered a very bad mutation. And that frog, of course, wouldn't survive, and it wouldn't successfully attract a mate, and it wouldn't have its offspring in the next generation. So here's some nuts and bolts. First, it's heredity, not culture, that gets transmitted. So say you're kind of a skinny guy, and you work out with weights, and you get really pumped up. You're not gonna transmit, you know, the big body build to your offspring. You're gonna transmit the skinny stuff. That's because it's the genetics, not the culture, that gets transmitted. However, this was dogma in Darwinism. Absolute dogma. If you said culture to them, that the culture got transmitted, they would call you names and tell you what a throwback you were. But it turns out in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a new development in biology that's called epigenetics, which has questioned the validity of their assumption. And so there's things like certain forms of obesity that lead to type 2 diabetes can now be transmitted to the offspring. So the cultural development can affect the next generation, which is, boy, this is a grand surprise, but some people at Notre Dame have been working on this rather diligently. They call it epigenetics. Okay, the importance of sexual mating can't be stressed enough. That's how you prove that you get fitness. So, you know, on a beautiful spring day, we hear a bird singing and singing and singing, but part of what that bird is doing is sending a signal. That's usually a male bird sending a signal to female bird about how strong I am, about how fit I am. Because if the bird doesn't have enough energy, it won't be able to keep up its song. And a bird that has an immature song won't attract the female. They want a song that's long and beautiful. And it also the color of the bird is another indicator. So you see these beautiful red cardinals, the males that are most colorful. That also attracts the female, because if the female sees the great color, the color indicates that the male is resistant to disease. It can't get the color if it doesn't have the resistance to disease. Remarkable, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's still beautiful. It's okay to just enjoy the birds. But there's a function to what they're doing. It's not just having a good time. And so it's part of the competition. Like fireflies, the ones that go up and light up the trees. Are fireflies? Yeah. Okay. And you know, it's amazing how they go higher and higher and higher. Well, it turns out that the higher they go, the higher the males go, the more attractive they are to females. And the brighter their light is, the more attractive it is to females. Now, it's still a beautiful summer show on a hot summer night, but there is a function going on in that. All right, so mutation is the first part of heredity and whatnot. Now, mutation happens by chemical agents can cause a mutation, radiation can cause a mutation, and it's also caused simply by different kinds of genetic shuffling that goes on. The mutation drives the system forward. The mutation gives the system dynamism and diversity. A good mutation. A bad mutation gets wiped out, by this next guy, which is natural selection. Natural selection is the judge. And it judges every mutation as either fit or unfit. If it thinks, the natural selection is a ghost. Because it's a lot like, if any of you do economics, it's a lot like the invisible hand of Adam Smith's economic theory. There isn't a real hand out there that's deciding how free markets work. So Adam Smith called it an invisible hand because it works that way with prices and supply and demand and so forth. But in evolution, natural selection decides what lives and what doesn't live. Now, is there some natural selector sitting over there? No. It's just like Adam Smith's invisible hand. It's just the way the system works, but it's called natural selection. This was Darwin's greatest discovery, is that there was natural selection. So, on to the third component, geologic time. If you have a small change, just a small change, say a little bit of color that gives you a little bit of camouflage, it's not complete. It's not great, but if nobody else has that, you're one step ahead of them. You're one step, maybe 10% less likely to get eaten by a bird. And over time, that 10% will win. So over time, what's going to populate are the ones that have that little bit. Even though it's not a complete camouflage, that'll beat out the ones that have no camouflage. But I'm talking about over like millions and millions of years. I'm not talking about a short period of time or a human life. So again, you got to keep thinking beyond the human lifespan. This is how things get complicated and complex when they started simply. Okay, can you see the hour hand of a clock move? This was a point that the great Teilhard de Chardin made. When you're looking at the hour hand of the clock, it's moving, but you can't see it. And that's what happens with evolution. It's moving so slowly that you can't see it. It's definitely moving. You know it's moving. You know, you go out of the room and you come back a half hour later, an hour later, and it's different. Now here, this I think is a shot just on River Road in St. Paul, near St. Thomas. One day I went out for a walk with a colleague in theology, a guy from the Ukraine, and we went and we hopped over that railing. There's like a horseshoe canyon, and we walked around the canyon, and we sat down on these rocks overlooking the Mississippi. We were sitting there talking, and I looked over to my left, and I saw this great big level. Never seen a level quite that long. And about 5 or 10 minutes later, this guy comes scampering up, and it was his level. And we struck up a conversation. It turns out this guy was a German geologist who had come to St. Paul for this geology conference. You know, and he's talking to us, you know, and he's saying, we asked him what he was doing there. He said, these rocks that you're sitting on are very famous rocks. So what's so important about them? He said, well, these rocks, not these, but underneath these rocks is volcanic ash from a volcano that erupted in South America, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of years ago. And my Ukrainian friends are very skeptical. And I'm a little skeptical myself. And he said, here, I show you. And so he gets down on his knees and he reaches underneath the rock, way, way, way underneath. He's stretching underneath. He pulls out, it's clearly volcanic ash. And so, there was a one-man question. So I said, how did it get here? He said, well, every year there was this shifting of the tectonic plates, and every year it moved like 1.5 centimeters north and west, and it finally ends up here. So a volcanic eruption in South America ends up in Minnesota with these famous rocks, because this guy was supposed to be across the river in Minneapolis at his convention. He said, I don't want to go to the afternoon one. I want to see the rocks, you know. So he comes over, and he sees the rocks, and he shows us this stuff. Now, here's a quiz question. Why did the German geologist have to reach way, way, way under the rock to find the ash? We have an evolution skeptic here. Any other guesses?
Erosion?
Oh, I'm sorry?
Erosion?
Erosion is a good guess, but it's not right.
Rock fell off the bluff. Fell off the side of the rock.
You're reaching with that. Okay. Yeah. All right, so we're 0 for 3. Wow. Okay, yes?
Was it deposited there by the river?
Oh, well, yeah, but why did he have to reach way under the rock? Why couldn't he have just reached right in the front of the rock? Why did he have to go to the back?
The other geologist dug it out already.
You got it.
Yes!
That's exactly right. So many of the geologists had come there and collected the sample of the volcanic ash that he had to reach all the way back. So this right here in St. Paul. So I said to this fellow, well, what about the river? And he looks at me, oh, the river, 30,000 years ago, a glacier comes through. We don't care about the river. So 30,000 years means nothing to these geologists. They're thinking in terms of millions and millions of years, sometimes in billions of years. Now, I'm telling you this to get your heads into the framework, which you can even begin to grasp the theory. You getting this? Good. I know you got it. All right, so sometimes what you don't see is important. Now, right now, we are on a planet that is hurtling through space, maybe 67,000 miles an hour or thereabouts. 108,000 kilometers for you. The species on Earth are constantly changing. 99% of the species that have ever existed are extinct. Actually, it's more than 99%. That should disturb you. It is disturbing. But it also should sober you just a bit about our ability to stop species from going extinct. All species are endangered. That's the way the evolutionary struggle takes place. Okay, hold it for if you can. We're almost to there, Nelson, if you can. But don't forget it. Stability and dynamism are central to the system. The system has to have a way of providing stability. Because if you thought you were hurtling through space at 108,000 kilometers per hour, you'd get dizzy. But you're not dizzy, are you? Nobody. And if you're dizzy, it's not because of the movement of the Earth. So there's stability, but it's moving. Likewise, evolution is moving, but there's stability. You don't see species changing. Maybe a little bit. You might track this one or that one. But you don't see how the whole thing is doing this. So the mutations provide novelty. Natural selection judges the novelty as fit or unfit, works or won't work, and both are essential, as is the geologic time. So you get two critical things you have to have from the physical universe, stability and dynamism. Again, I'd say that's a tribute to the Creator. All right, every advantage that you get in evolution matters. A little bit more speed, you have a better chance of outrunning a predator or catching the prey. But brains are really important too. Let's get a little closer to home. chimpanzees, who are our closest relatives in the apes, basically, in the, not monkeys, by the way, just get that right. It's not monkeys, it's apes, it's chimps. Human beings and chimps had a common ancestor 7 million years ago. We had a common ancestor, but then they developed along one line, and then there were these ancestors of human beings that developed along another line, so-called hominids. You know, there's all kinds of different names, Homo ergaster, Homo habilis, and so forth. And finally, you get to the Neanderthals, and then you get to Homo sapiens, which are anatomically modern humans like us in the room. All right, but let's go back to brains. So the chimps, who have a 97% genetic overlap with us, if you look at the DNA of a chimp, and you look at the DNA of a human being, there's a 97% overlap. However, the chimp brain uses about 8% of its metabolism. The human brain uses 22% of its metabolism. Now, brains are wonderful evolutionary tools. If you got brains, you're going to do better than if you don't, long term, on average. But brains are expensive, because to have a big brain, you need a big head. We all have big heads. I mean that not metaphorically, just literally. Okay, so how do you get these big heads? Well, this is part of the natural selection theory of how humans evolve big heads. They got, because the woman's birth canal can't be too large, otherwise she wouldn't be able to walk or run, and could only do so very clumsily. So natural selection can't do it that way. So what it did was, it got it as big, the head as big as it could be, and then it played a little trick. It had human babies all born 9 months, or actually about 11 months, premature. So every child that's born, all of us in this room, were born premature. Because for the first year of your life, your brain continued to grow at a rapid pace postpartum, outside of the womb. It's a brilliant way of getting something extra in natural selection. Now remember, I'm trying to show you the deepest, darkest stuff tonight. Now next week I'm going to show you why it actually works to our advantage in terms of our faith. But so you got to... Yeah, don't go home and have bad dreams or throw away your Bible or anything like that. Just stay with us for tonight. We'll get through this, and next week we'll answer how these things actually become advantages. All right, so now here's the real nasty turn. Even mother love, the tenderness of mother love, is a trick of natural selection. That's what the atheist biologist will tell you. Now, I'm forced to tell you that tonight. I'll tell you something else next week. But for now, let's just leave it there. Okay, so almost every animal is in danger either of being eaten or in danger of failing to eat other animals. So if you're a lion and you're too slow to catch the prey, you're going to be a starving lion. And you're going to die, and you're not going to have offspring, and your offspring aren't going to go in the next generation. You have to be strong enough and fast enough to catch the food. And if you want to be, unless you want to become lion food, you have to be strong enough and fast enough to get away. This poem from Alfred Lord Tennyson was very famous and disturbed people greatly after Darwin's discoveries. That nature was red in tooth and claw. This became a new way of looking at nature. That nature was real, wasn't this beautiful, peaceful British countryside, and where we could sing hymns like about the glories of the beauty of the earth and so forth. That's what happened here theologically in the late 19th century. that nature suddenly became seen as red in tooth and claw, where it's about being attacked and being torn apart and all that kind of ugly stuff. That's what we have to do, or show how that challenge becomes an advantage. Okay, death became very shocking. Now, we all know about death. We've known, most of us, since we were kids, when a pet died or a relative died. And we all know that each individual is going to die. But what 19th century England discovered was that entire species die. And the way they discovered this was the machinery. They were digging railroad lines, and then they were digging a canal, the Somerset Canal. And as they were digging, they went deeper and deeper down, and the further down they went, the more fossils they found, and the more depth to the dig, the less the fossils were like what preceded. So right near the surface, everything looked pretty much like it looks now. We went down a little different, get down way deep, and it looked way, way different. This was what was called faunal succession. And the idea being that this is where it really began to break onto people that the ancients were different. The ancient animals were different. And it also shocked the English because they realized most of them were dead. They didn't survive. So there's the geologic time. I can never keep all those periods straight. I tried once or twice, and I've given up. But these are millions and millions, even billions of years. And so we have disturbing implications. What does it mean that 99% of the species that have ever lived are extinct? And then there's this thing called intelligent design. How many of you have heard of the term intelligent design? Okay. This has been a kind of a Christian response. I know some of the people actually who are involved in that. They're good people. I think they're wrong. Now, what they have right is that if God created, it has to be intelligent. It can't be like God woke up one day and just forgot or something or slipped and all of a sudden the universe came into being by mistake. It had to be intelligent. It had to be by design. And we know that it was. In the beginning was the... Thank you. Okay, so you see, I've set this up. Okay, so we've already... That, of course creation's intelligent. And of course creation is designed. But did God sit around somewhere in heaven and design the human eye? And what this theory is going to say, evolution says, and I think they're right, no. What Richard Dawkins, who's one of the bad boys who gets on Time magazine, he's an atheist, but he's a great biologist in many ways. And what he says is, if you had an eye, imagine that you had not a beautiful eye, a complete eye, the complicated eye, but let's say you've got a creature that has no eye whatsoever, and you've got one that can just detect a little bit of movement, maybe it can detect light and it can detect shadow, then it's already got a huge advantage over its competitors. And then let's say that just slowly evolves into where you don't see as well as we do, but you see half as well as we do. It's a huge advantage over no sight at all. Anyway, this is the theory of how the eye evolves over millions and millions or even billions of years. This is a thing that's taken from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, I think it is, but it's the companion to Alice in Wonderland. And there's a thing called the Red Queen effect that evolutionary biologists talk about. This is where you have to run faster and faster to stay in place. So there's an arms race in the evolutionary world where the predators get faster and faster, and the prey also gets trickier and harder to find and so forth. So you got to keep going. You can't stop. If you stop and you stop your development, you'll have a problem. Now, we're going to pick up on that when we get to the parable of the talents in a few minutes. This was a picture I think Darwin first came up with. He noticed the anatomy, the similarity of human, cat, whale, and bat. And he was right. The anatomy is similar, and there are good reasons for that. These work well. So once something works well, more than one species may adopt it. Okay, chimp and human hemoglobin, for instance, are 100% the same. Hemoglobin is the part of the red blood cell that carries oxygen. It's 100% the same in chimps and human beings. That's real hard to say is accidental, but this is the kind of thing that DNA studies have revealed. Darwin never used the term evolution. He called it descent with modification. Now, here's the next disturbing part of the theory. Do animals have morality? Now, there's a Dutch fellow in Atlanta who set up this zoo, big outdoor space, and studied chimps there. And you can see there's a kind of a motherly love going on there. And here they are grooming each other. I want to tell a story about some adolescent chimps in Atlanta at the Arnhem Zoo. This was that Franz Duval saw. They had a rule that they had successfully taught all the chimps that they had to come in and nobody would be fed at dinner time unless everybody came in. The entire community of chimps had to come in. So one balmy evening, a couple of adolescent females, chimps, were having a good time strolling and doing whatever adolescent chimps do on a balmy Atlanta night. And everybody else was indoors waiting for their food, but they couldn't get it because these two were out there. So finally, the zookeepers went out, collected those two, and brought them in. But they knew. Chimps are violent, nasty animals, by the way. Do not try to get one for a pet or something. They will kill you if they're in a bad mood that day. They're really rather vile, I think. So they had to protect these two adolescent chimps because they thought the rest of the group, which was mightily angry for having their dinner delayed, would do something bad to them. So they put them in separate quarters. Now, they kept them separate as long as they could, but they had to reintroduce them to the community at some point. Late the next day, when they did, some representatives from the community went over to those two adolescent females and delivered a sound beating, which was like an enforcement of group morality, or so Franz Duval thinks. So, do chimps even have a primitive form of morality? Elephants, likewise, seem to have strong family attachments. Now, here you see a fallen elephant, and I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of this, but elephants are amazingly bright, and when someone falls, they will go over and they'll nudge them and they'll do what they can to try to get them back up on their feet. And if they can't, then the elephant dies. They will return to that spot again and again and again. And sometimes if the tusk has been separated, they will even pass the tusk around. So it seems that they have a form of morality. And now this questions whether or not we are unique. Are we made in the image of God if we share 97% of our DNA with a chimp and these kind of moral behaviors with chimps and elephants and so forth? Those are the questions that I'm going to try not to answer tonight, but next week we're going to start, and each week we're going to answer one of the challenges. Well, there we are. So let's take, thank you for sitting through all that, and let's take questions. And I do want to tell you about one thing that's coming up on Tuesday, April 30th at St. Thomas. We have a very, very, we'll have a free public lecture at 7:30 by Ken Kemp, who is an expert on evolution and Catholicism. He spent a lot of time in the Vatican, going through the papers of the Vatican, on Teilhard Chardin, on all kinds of different people. But this will definitely be worth coming to. It will be his farewell, because he's retiring. He's lost his hearing, but he can speak, and will have file cards so you can ask questions. Kemp is particularly good at the Catholic position on Adam and Eve. So this is Tuesday, April 30th. It's in the Anderson Student Center, the third floor, in what's called Wolf Hall South. And you can get inexpensive parking just across the street at the corner of Creighton and Grand. There's a big parking ramp there. And it's maybe a 3 to 5 minute walk to Anderson from there. So it's conveniently located at 7:30. And again, Ken Kemp is, he is just one of the world's experts in this. And he also translated the Polish Archbishop's work from Polish to English on evolution. So he really, really knows the Catholic position and the issues and or where all the controversies have been. All right, let's open this up. Let's do this. Let's take a 5 minute break, and then we'll get some refreshments, and then we'll take questions.